You're listening to FMGRadio.com. Welcome to Generation Reinvention, How Baby Boomers Are Changing the Future, with your host, Brent Green.
WPP is the world's largest communication services group. You've never heard of WPP? Well, this company employs 153,000 people working in 2,400 offices in 107 countries, generating more than $14 billion in annual sales. Founded in 1985 by Sir Martin Sorrell of Great Britain, WPP functions as a 21st century equivalent of the full-service marketing agency, acting as a portal to provide a single point of contact and accountability and the full spectrum of modern marketing services. Some of the famous companies that fall within the WPP rubric include Ogilvy & Mather Worldwide, Hill & Knowlton, J. Walter Thompson, Young & Rubicon, Burson Marsteller, and Wunderman, the great direct marketing company. In a nutshell, WPP now includes many of the legendary global ad agencies and PR firms that flourished during the 20th century. John Zweig is chairman of healthcare and specialist communications for WPP. His role is to develop the group's capabilities and coordinate client services on behalf of WPP's firms specialized by discipline, audience, and industry. With a particular emphasis on healthcare clients, John provides access to these resources and capabilities around the world. Prior to becoming CEO of WPP's branding and identity, healthcare, and specialist communications businesses, John was president of Thomas Ferguson Associates and founded Common Health in 1992. During the 10-year course of his leadership, he helped build Common Health into the largest and most respected integrated marketing firm of its type. His prior experience was at Procter & Gamble, where he was product and category manager for a variety of consumer health and packaged goods brands. Earlier in his career, he was partner at the Waymaker Institute, a management consulting firm specializing in organizational behavior and corporate mission research and development. So I take a great deal of pride in welcoming to Generation Reinvention, John Zweig.
Well, thanks very much, Brent. That was such a fabulously comprehensive and enthusiastic description of WPP. We would probably like to put you on the investor relations team.
Thank you. Only I botched it once and was about ready to say WWP, and I'm going, wait a minute. So anyway, I'll try not to have any more verbal gaffes during our interview today and get it right every time. But I wanted, if you could, this introduction did give a sense of the large and significant marketing company that you work for, but can you give us a brief understanding of your journey through this global advertising agency world that you live in?
I'm sure I'd be delighted to. I like to just add to that description of the structure of WPP with just a couple of words about its purpose. And when you consider all of those individual companies, some of the brands that you mentioned, and literally 100 or more that you didn't, mostly assembled through acquisition, but over the years have been increasingly working together in an integrated fashion, you know, as a marketing expert yourself, that we're always talking about integrated marketing. So the way that I like to think about it in terms of what we do, the actual disciplines, is, well, it starts with the idea that clients, global corporations who are global corporations are the most powerful, arguably the most powerful social institutions in the world. We know that they have to have a counterpart in terms of linking their products and services to the needs and aspirations of people. So, of course, that's where we come in. And if you divide WPP up into sort of its broad categories, it starts with our research business. We have the second largest research and information business in the world. And of course, the function there is to generate insight and data to help our clients make better decisions. And you talked a little bit about our public relations firms, Hill & Knowlton, Burson, Marsteller, and others. They primarily use editorial or credible influence, news, et cetera, to help to further the aims of our clients. We have a very sizable media business, the largest in the world, in fact, and you know that's where the economies of scale really come in, because the idea is that we have to be able to reach any person anywhere in the world through any of the myriad of different media that there are. The large agencies that you describe, Thompson, Ogilvy, Y&R, et cetera, they are really experts in global branding or in taking those messages leveraged through our media buying power and communicating them everywhere. And then we have this piece that you mentioned, which had been my area of responsibility for the last 12 to 15 years, that are specialized by discipline. So those would be things like direct marketing or package design or corporate identity, by audience. And those audiences may include teens or even kids in some cases when we can do it morally and ethically. The aging population, of course, we'll talk more about that. That is an example of an audience. We have agencies that reach Hispanic populations in this country, African-American populations, gay and lesbian. There's a segment now that describes almost every demographic or aging or cultural group. And then finally, you mentioned industries. So healthcare is an example of one of our largest collection of businesses, and it does include pharmaceutical products, but more. And that's the piece that I'm responsible for. So I came into WPP through a healthcare agency that I was running at the time that we sold it to Sir Martin Sorrell, and WPP, of course, is a public company. And after completing 4 to 5 years within WPP running the healthcare businesses, then I took on these other responsibilities. And I would say that over the course of those years that I've committed to WPP, I've really encountered every imaginable marketing problem or opportunity, and it's been a very satisfying way to spend this significant chunk of my life.
It's an amazing set of responsibilities and just boggles my imagination. My background is in advertising also, but I always worked for regional advertising agencies, handling some of the larger accounts like McDonald's and so forth, but not from the perspective from where you sit. And there's many things that we could talk about today. Obviously, the breadth of what you're involved in invites conversation on many different tracks. But because this show is Generation Reinvention, you know that I want to focus a lot on the relationship between marketing, advertising, aging, and business. And I saw a very interesting editorial letter by you in the New York Times. And if you don't mind, I'm going to read a couple of sentences from it. You wrote that one disadvantage of a career in the advertising and marketing business is the constant reminder of how our culture worships youth. Not surprisingly, this, along with the explosive growth of digital media, doesn't necessarily favor the 60-something ad person. And I wondered if you could reflect on that a little bit. What's it like to be in such a youth-dominated business, as it's traditionally been anyway, when market reality suggests that this should be an age-dominated business in most product categories?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, the first thought that occurs to me is that one feels lucky just to be employed at all.
yes.
You know, because what you say is really true. And as a result, by the time, you know, people are my age, 61, if you aren't, you know, if you aren't running something fairly sizable, there is a good chance that you'll be you know, you'll be running a bed and breakfast or doing something in an entirely different industry, because there is a, you know, there is a tendency just to meet the perceived market targets of our clients to continue to put the talent into younger and younger people, particularly as the explosion of digital media. So what's it like? I would say that it's a sort of a combination of a struggle and a fantastic opportunity. You know, you would like to think that all of those years of experience translate into some value to subsequent generations. Not necessarily the case. I'm sure, you know, you've heard the expression, you know, he doesn't have 30 years of experience. He has 1 year of experience 30 times over.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the fact in many cases. So I think the most interesting challenge for me, being responsible for identifying, recruiting, bringing new people on and motivating them, is to make some useful purpose out of those experiences that I have had. And of course, I strive to do that all the time, and sometimes succeed and sometimes don't.
Well, I think both agree, and I think the marketing world in general is beginning to agree that boomers and older generations are a powerful market force, but they're often being ignored by mainstream media. So why do you think that big media companies and advertising agencies sometimes just seem to fail to get this message? Now, I realize that in some of your core business, like pharmaceutical, they get it. But across the, you know, broad spectrum of clients and businesses, we still feel that there's a ageism that kind of is operative. Do you perceive that from the position you sit at WPP?
Well, it's certainly nothing like it it was. If you look at many of our major clients, and you know, Ford and IBM and big banks and big consumer products companies, Unilever, Procter & Gamble, and so on, all of them will have in their strategic planning function some, you know, fairly well-developed program of understanding the needs of this older segment and developing products and communication to reach them. So it's not quite like it used to be. We've been singing this song about the consumer marketers' ignorance of the older population probably for a little bit longer now than we should. But what you can certainly say is that the success in reaching this group is variable, and certainly resources aren't committed at the same level or in proportion to the actual opportunity. Now, you know, that gets into the whole question, which you're an expert in, I hasten to add for your listeners, of, you know, are younger people somehow more receptive to messages than, and older people somehow more set in their ways? What's your point of view on that, Brent?
Well, I've been through this many times, as you well know, John, and I obviously believe that the boomer generation in particular has been marketed to since it was in diapers. We've been presented a plethora of product choices at every stage of our lives. We know that there are brand trade-offs wherever we turn, and we are hardly the kind of generation that is set in its ways. We are the phenomenon of the marketing industry in the modern era, and we uniquely started our lives with only three television networks, which created a very strongly shared narrative and allowed consumer products companies to reach us rather broadly and homogeneously with consistent messages. And so we created businesses. We created McDonald's. We created, in a sense, we created Starbucks. We grew the brand Levi's. So to say that we're set in our ways is obviously pretty ridiculous. And actually, consumer research done by a number of organizations, MetLife, Mature Marketing Institute, AARP, and others, has shown that boomers are probably less brand loyal than younger generations in a lot of ways, because they're not as shaped by the force of their social networks. There's a lot more individuation and autonomy among people as they age in general, and certainly in the boomer generation. So anybody out there that thinks they have a lock on boomers because they're a legacy brand better rethink that.
I knew you would have some brilliant insight on that subject, and I'm not disappointed. Now, you know, this quickly, this question of why isn't it more effective certainly addresses the overall question of why isn't all marketing more effective, and there are still far more new product failures, you know, across the board than there are successes, and you know that. And then when you get to how do we reach older people more effectively, well, you know, then you come up against some very, very complex and subtle issues, even existential ones. The late Robert Butler, with whom I had the pleasure of working for a number of years, and of course he started the National Institute of Aging, and he gave John Glenn his physical before he went up in space. He describes ageism as corrosive narcissism, or the inability to consider and accept our own inevitable fate. So there's a lot there when it comes to the question of, you know, why don't we embrace age? A lot of it may have to do with the tendency that we have to deny that we ourselves are aging. So it might be a little too much to expect marketers, who are, after all, just people too, to be really adept at this, because at its deepest level, you know, we're all fearing that aging signals our inevitable decline and ultimately our death. So when you get to the question of our mortality and what's the relationship of that psychology to marketing, well, you're also a psychologist, so you probably have some interesting things to say about that as well.
Well, this much I will say, reflecting your comments about Robert Butler, which I know that we both have enormous respect for, and I had the opportunity actually of meeting you at his organization, the International Longevity Center. I quote him in his concept of ageism as the fearsome thought of growing old, which absolutely reflects what you just said. So we need to take a break, but this is a great conversation. My guest is John Zweig, chairman of WPP's divisions focused on specialists and healthcare communications. When we come back, we're going to speak with John more about his personal journey and how it dovetails with the marketing industry's evolution to refocusing on boomers and older markets.
You're listening to the FMG Radio Network, where our motto is have fun, make money, do good. We provide platforms to individuals who have a cause, message, or information that they would like to share with the world. If you'd like to join the FMG family and have your own radio show, please call us at 1-800-470-4982. That's 1-800-470-4982. We look forward to hearing from you.
John Zweig served with distinction in a combatant role in Vietnam and later in other Asian countries as a race relations educational specialist for the U.S. Navy. He attended both Washington University and the University of the State of New York. Prior to entering business, John was a professional jazz guitarist and studio musician, having performed on national television and radio commercials. That begs a question. Are you still involved in music, John?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I played last night.
All right.
The neighborhood jazz club had a fantastic little combo of a singer singing beautiful standards, a bass player, an upright bass player, and a very young and, you know, somebody whose name you'll learn at some point, Nathan Webb, drummer, who was a top of the class of the William Patterson Jazz Program. So, yes, I still play, and I consider myself very lucky to be able to have that outlet.
Very interesting, and I just think that's very special to know that about you, because I think we boomers like to have our creative outlets. We were kind of came of age during a zeitgeist of creative ferment when all of the great rock bands, the classic rock bands, were, you know, answering our dreams, if you will, about our lives and the creativity of pop art and things like that. And I think I have a chapter on that in one of my books, that basically this creative drive runs through the generation like a red thread. We all have that part of ourselves that we like to preserve. And another thing that stands out about your background that I would like to ask you about a little bit, you've already expressed your age, which would suggest to me that you are somebody that was born around 1950, and you did serve in Vietnam, and I arguably Vietnam was the boomer generation's defining war, and had a lot of influence on shaping our thinking and our goals, whether we served or we didn't serve. Did it have any influence on leading you to where you are today, that chapter of your life?
Oh, absolutely it did. You know, I, like many of the generation that, you know, that I represent, as you got it right on the nail of the head, of 1950 is the actual year when I was born. Our father served in World War II. So unlike today, there were a relatively smaller percentage of people. I mean, it's still over 1.5 million, I think, who have been in either Afghanistan or Iraq. But, you know, a child today is less likely to have a parent who was in the military. And for those of us who did, and in World War II, we grew up with those stories. And sometimes they were romanticized. And sometimes if you're a son of a father who received a Silver Star at the Battle of the Bulge like mine and a couple of Bronze Stars, you know, you consider that legacy something of a standard to try to achieve oneself. Now, I didn't have a fraction of the experience that he did, but I did see enough action to, you know, to develop some kind of appreciation for how people deal with their fear. And that was interesting. And sometimes, of course, it was the people who you expected to be scared were not, and those who had all the, you know, who came from the academies and who had all the bravado were the ones, you know, I won't say crying for their mommies, but it came close a few times. And so I think that question of where do these connections come from, you know, with our deeper self and our external experience, is very much related to marketing, because, you know, at its best, marketing is trying to, you know, reach that unarticulated part of a person's, you know, whether it's their wishes or their hopes or their fears or their dreams or their aspirations. And it's not just to play on them. I think those days of marketing, as you know so well, of tricking people or manipulating people into buying your product, are thankfully gone. And now we have to really meet these needs in some way. And so it was that idea of marketing, you know, at its best, that evolved from my own experience in how do people react, what do people want, how do they interact with each other. And then, of course, ultimately, this interest in health as more than just a physical thing, but also a kind of a psychic and an environmental and even certainly a social and even a spiritual matter, or integrating all of those things, I guess you could say, makes someone really healthy, became kind of fascinating fodder for my experience in the pharmaceutical industry. So absolutely, okay. That military experience was helpful.
I when you were speaking about the fear and seeing that in a very palpable way, I was thinking of the great writer. I don't know if you're familiar with Tim O'Brien, who wrote a book called "The Things They Carried," but it is it's the best book I've ever read about the experience of being a soldier in Vietnam. And Things They Carried is now treated as literature and taught in high schools alongside Hemingway and Steinbeck. And he also happens to be of the boomer generation. And he broke out as a successful author with the publishing of a book in 1978, which won the National Book Award. It was called Going After Ketchy Otto. But I digress, but I was thinking about that when you were mentioning some of your own personal witness of some of the experience of being a soldier in that environment. Well,
I might just add, Brent, that This very day, Veterans Day, my father, who's going to be 92 next July, is visiting the local high school and giving 7 or 8 15-minute presentations on what it was like in World War II. So, and what he learned from it, and even more important, you know, what relevance does it have to this generation that he's now speaking to? Not just in terms of trying to get people to appreciate the history of it, but getting people to understand that, you know, when you are called upon to do something that requires digging into deeper resources within yourself, how will you choose to do it? And what tools will you have? And so I'm very proud of him. I've learned an enormous amount from him.
I fully respect what your father's doing, and the great gift of this intergenerational transfer of wisdom is priceless. The young people that will hear him today will benefit from insights that I'm sure they will carry with them in some way the rest of their lives. So congratulations to your father. That's wonderful to hear. So shifting gears back a little bit to what we're doing from a business perspective, you helped found Common Health, and which is now Ogilvy Common Health. Can you describe this organization, a little background on it and its focus, so that our listeners can understand the importance of health marketing within the context of WPP?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a really interesting study in the difference between, you know, what we would consider to be the product itself. In the case of pharmaceutical marketing, it's all, you know, it's almost always a tablet or a capsule. Sometimes it's an injectable. You know, sometimes it's a device. And the difference between that, if you will, the hardware, and then the surrounding context of information, which you want to be of service to either the influencer or the purchaser or the user. So to answer your question about, you know, how I got there, I was responsible, as you summarized in my little bio, for a number of consumer products at Procter & Gamble, and they're outstanding marketers. So I learned something about
truly
the discipline of having a clear strategy and a product that does make some kind of a contribution to people, as opposed to just another product duplication. That's something that Procter & Gamble understands very well. But I enjoyed working on some of those brands like Pepto-Bismol or Crest or Scope, products that had a health-related benefit. First, it was kind of more interesting to me inherently. You know, you could learn something about it, which was almost always applicable to yourself or to your family or to your friends. And secondly, and this is particularly helpful as we get older and our standards for the meaning in our work grow, we hope, it was more meaningful to work on health-related products. So I found a relatively small, probably 25 people or so, healthcare agency, and you know, armed with what I'd learned from P&G, went about going to the clients of this small agency, which I joined, trying to convince them that, hey, there's more to health than, as I say, just this tablet or this capsule. And it was a very effective sales presentation. So the business grew, you know, from 25 or 30 to, well, it's over 1,000 people today. And I think one of the things that made that experience so successful was this, you know, very point that I'm trying to make, which is that, you know, these agencies are not just pharmaceutical advertising services, but if we think about health in the broadest sense, it is this integration of our mind, body, social, and physical environments. And all of those dimensions of health are kind of fair game for communicating to the either the patient or even the doctor, or in some cases, it's the people who surround, you know, it's the audiences have gotten more and more complex, including regulators and insurance and business people, and of course, many allied health workers. So it really was an exercise in going beyond the product and to think about and to help our clients understand that they could access these as sources of motivation. Now, everybody knows and or has heard about the placebo effect. And, you know, I was relatively new to pharmaceutical marketing when I started having to read those studies about the prescription drugs. And, and in some cases, you know, the placebo effect would be 30, 40%. So that like a third of the people in many of these pain studies who received inert medicines actually got better. And I used that amazing fact to at least get our own people to understand first, and then our clients, that if people's expectations have that kind of an impact, then that means that the communication is not just extolling the virtues of the product, but it's part of the therapy itself. And it really remains one of the most fascinating and overlooked facts, the placebo effect. And its negative corollary, some people call it the nocebo effect, which is, you know, how do the things that create people's fear or distrust or suspicion have the opposite effect? In an age where informed consent is, you know, legitimately so important, you're always trying to strike that balance between saying something that will give a person hope and yet at the same time informing them about the, you know, the real risks that there are. And there's no, of course, there's no answer to it. But it's one of the things that makes healthcare marketing so fascinating. And our more astute clients, and, you know, we have clients in all the major pharmaceutical and healthcare companies, but Johnson & Johnson is a great example. They really do define their mission in terms of health. And their marketing all sort of emanates from their credo, which makes improving people's health their first priority. Now, like all of us, we don't always succeed, but the idea that they take this as seriously as they do, and it's part of our own relationship with them, is again, it's not only one of the areas that makes the business as successful as it is, because I don't have to tell you as the marketer that you are, how many elements of a marketing world, even including things like travel and leisure, have some impact on health. But so it's not only a very successful business that continues to grow despite the struggle of the economy. It also makes it meaningful, so that the people who work in these businesses are motivated to bring more of themselves to the job, which is something, of course, that we encourage.
I was watching a video, an animated video on Ogilvy Common Health, and I would encourage our listeners to Google Ogilvy Common Health and take a look at a video called Earthborn, or it's for Earthborn, and it shows a woman in an animated, real woman, but in an animated setting, being inundated with a lot of pollution and air allergens and things like that. And she inhales a inhaler to try to mitigate it. And then the video ends with a message: our planet's health is our health. So this kind of addresses what you were just saying, John, about the mission is larger than just the mitigation of a specific disease with a specific pill or injection or something like that.
Absolutely. You know, that's a great example. And it, you know, it was a competitively powerful tool just as a discipline to think in those terms, because let's face it, our the things that you might take a Claritin, if we use that as an example, an allergy pill for, well, it could be any number of things. I mean, you could wake up on the first morning when the heat kicks in, like, you know, is happening now with winter finally coming, or you could live in a polluted area, or it could be pathogens, and you could get you could actually be getting an infection. But all of those things create the symptoms of not being able to breathe as well. And they all should remind us that you know, clean air is probably one of these inalienable rights that we talk, as we talk about our forefathers. That may be one that you know, that we ought to add to the list.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to take another short break for our sponsors. And when we come back, I'm going to ask our guest, John Zweig, to discuss some of the advanced models of marketing to aging cohorts that he's seen rise from his activities at WPP. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Be sure to join us at fmguniversity.com, where we can turn your passion into business within 30 days, put some fun back into your life, and show you how to make money and do good for yourself and others. That's why we're called FMG, Fun, Money, Good. Get started today. Visit us at fmguniversity.com.
John Zweig's board service includes the International Leadership Center on Longevity and a focus on productive aging. This is an affiliate of Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York. He has been a regular keynote speaker at New York Times Foundation seminars and authored a chapter called Maturing of Marketing, part of the 20th Century Foundation's book series. He is also on the board of the Farbrook School in Short Hills, New Jersey, and served as a trustee for the National Council of the Lewis and Clark Bicentennial. So, John, what are some of the major insights that you've identified in your chapter, Maturing of Marketing, for a book that was entitled 20th Century's Life for an Older America? What are some of the things that you talked about in that chapter?
Well, it was an interesting exercise, Brent, because when you looked at this area, it's of course fraught with contradictions. We talked a little bit about some of them. There's all this opportunity, yet marketers frequently ignore it. There are many what appear to be logical moves. I mean, somebody could there was a product once for a hair product for 50 plus, and nobody wanted to identify themselves as 50 plus, so it didn't do particularly well. So, you know, you've got probably one of the most interesting, complex, and really difficult marketing challenges when you talk about trying to communicate effectively to this audience. And what I found, and of course, you know this literature so very well, having really spent a good part of your current career in the subject and talking to all the experts, there have been many approaches. You know, one of the first was Ken Dykewald, just with his book *The Age Wave*, that identified it. And you know, it was a wonderful example of how it's simply attracting attention to how big this was played a powerful role in marketing. So that was probably, in some respects, step one. There was a lot that has been written, and in the Yankelovich books, I think you would find that they look at it from a cohort standpoint. So, you know, whether you're a baby boomer or a Generation X or a Generation Y, that theory is that we tend to behave in a manner that's kind of consistent with where we were in that time that when we were born. And there's some validity to that. There have been academics and other consultants who've written a great deal about the psychographics. One of them I saw was actually a book called Gerontographics that took the attitudinal approach and said, you know, where somebody is in the older part of their life, you know, whether they were isolated from others or continuing to behave like they did when they were younger, or even what ages their children are and what activities that brought them into became the sort of determining factors. And all of those approaches, you know, or models have their place when you're marketing. But as I say, what's fascinating to me is that almost no matter which one you look at, there will be notable contradictions and even failures for almost any statistic that you find, including the one that you helped to illuminate a little while ago, earlier in our conversation, that, you know, are older consumers more or less likely to adopt new products? I can find evidence on both sides of the equation. And so what I always found interesting just about the matter is it always reflects the biggest issues that we have in our culture. And, you know, probably my favorite starting point when we talk about paradox or contradictions was the title of a a book, a Rockefeller Foundation book, John Knowles wrote. It was called Doing Better, But Feeling Worse. And I thought, wow, this in simple language, this really says it all. Because here we are, you know, in one of these periods of advancing technology where we have just this tremendous array of tools that are supposed to make our life better, and in many cases do. But yet, at the same time, you know, we have record, I think you're something like three times more likely to suffer clinical depression if you were born after 1945 than before. Stress-related illnesses, heart attacks, strokes, failed marriages, relationships, substance abuse. You know, you run the gamut of all these terrible things, and you have to say, wow, well, maybe all these great advances don't necessarily make our life better. And so probably one of the most interesting approaches to you know, to dealing with that paradox is to look at these problems, which I'm sure during your years as a consular therapist, you saw that, you know, there's no product that you're going to buy that's going to address your feelings of isolation or alienation. You know, we may think that more goods or more wrinkle cream or more empathic therapist or a new partner is going to be the answer, but in almost every case we find that it is not. So that's what really fascinates me the most, is how marketing opportunities are reflections of these bigger questions of, you know, who our identity. It gets us back to where we you know, where we were at the beginning. It's Dr. Butler's quote about the fear of death. So that's something that I'm sure you have some experience or insight of your own that you could add to the discussion.
Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the FMG Radio Network, where our motto is have fun, make money, do good. We provide platforms to individuals who have a cause, message, or information that they would like to share with the world. If you'd like to join the FMG family and have your own radio show, please call us at 1-800-470-4982. That's 1-800-470-4982. We look forward to hearing from you.
I really appreciate the direction you're taking this conversation, John, to take a look at the meta values, if you will, that are connected to the marketing communication models that are being developed, because, you know, I'm part of the ferment of the lifestyles of health and sustainability movement, if you will, which kind of emanates ground zero from Boulder, which is really a effort to integrate larger thoughts about the world at large and our place in it and the legacy that we as the current human beings living on this planet are going to be leaving for human beings that will be on the planet 100 years from now. Things like that are part of it. And, you know, it's part of that challenge and part of the thing that I have difficulty figuring out where we are, and that is embracing the entire circle of life. We do know that our culture is traditionally rejected, you know, the older adult in a meaningful way. That, of course, is changing. In a May article in the New York Times heralded a consciousness shift among the networks about targeting the 55-plus with programming. And heads of research for NBC and CBS have insisted that programmers start considering the boomer demographic. So we know that there's shifts in happening, and part of it is connected with the maturing and the aging of the Western world. I still struggle to connect the dots. And so one of the questions that I circle back to, are you seeing shortcomings in the way businesses are conceiving the 50-plus market strategy? Obviously, your core clients in the pharmaceutical industry probably do not. But looking beyond that, do you see shortcomings in the 50-plus market strategy?
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, you know, let's face it, any of us who are working in, you know, in this climate today, see shortcomings in just about every aspect of whether it's marketing or the leadership of our employees or the way that we kind of seem to value money over human beings, you know, that's going to express itself in lots of different ways. And certainly, if marketing is going to be really effective, it's going to have to find a way of getting at some of these deeper goals or issues that you're referring to. Now, you know, I have a tendency to think about them as, first, what are the problems? And, you know, if you were to try to find, say, three or four different characteristics that seem to be consistent among the research that we do, and whether it's a target audience, and, you know, frankly, this is somewhat more true as people age, and as I say, it's a reflection for that those elements of our culture that are unsatisfying. But people do feel alienated, and people do feel isolated. And, you know, unfortunately, not too many people really have the faith that, you know, that there's going to be something beyond death. It's obviously an important religious question, but it's a practical one, too, because if you think that you're born, life sucks, and then you die, well, you very quickly, you know, you do become subject to those feelings of depression. Mm-hmm. So whether it's this lack of autonomy that we feel, inability to make choices for ourselves, or this lack of unity that we feel, that we're kind of socially isolated, you know, they all will have a positive corollary. And so I'm always interested in saying if the positives, or let's just say they would be, instead of feeling powerless, that you do have some kind of a power, and not just the power as we tend to define it, the power over people or the power of status or the power of money, but in a way the power to help, or the power to become, or the power to know something, or those kind of powers. And let's say that if you feel that you're always depending upon somebody else, what would a product be like if it really expressed your autonomy? And instead of this feeling of fragmentation and isolation, what if we had products that helped us to connect to other people, to feel some sense of unity? And then finally, if we really do feel that life is so temporal, what would be those things? And you mentioned one of them, legacy, that would help us to believe that there's, you know, there's more to it than this very brief moment here on Earth. And of course, you can look at every single product or service, not just in the context of how they contribute to health in that broad sense that I mentioned earlier, you know, whether it's a mental or a physical or an environmental or a social thing. But what are these values, as you say, these deeper values, and what's a product's contribution to a person's sense of autonomy or sense of positive power or a sense of unity or even a sense of longevity? And I think that's a very, very fertile area where we're just beginning to really just scratching the surface. And the implications are significant. I mean, I know that you participate in some very interesting programming and seminars and events that are designed to help companies to get at how they may have to change in order to do this. Any particular examples that you've seen recently that come to mind?
Well, going back to your question that I really didn't answer head on regarding mortality and that dimension of our lives' influence on our contemporary lives, even from a marketing business standpoint, I reflect on the fact that I have spoken on five occasions to national conferences on the hospice movement. And the hospice movement really is a boomer movement, because if you look at the CEOs of the world's leading hospices, certainly the nation's leading hospices, most of them are baby boomers. And they came of age right as Elizabeth Kubler-Ross wrote her famous book called On Death and Dying. And that changed the conversation. And the way that I see the implications of that are profound to think about and have enormous implications that are worth considering. Our national conversation about death is changing a lot because of baby boomers. Look at the death of Michael Jackson, Farrah Fawcett, Patrick Swayze. And suddenly the departure of these people from this life have become much more center stage instead of pushed aside or not dealt with. And a lot of the choices these people make are precursors to the way I think things are moving. I think in particular, John, about Randy Pausch. He was the professor at Carnegie Mellon who was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. It became a celebrity in the last year of his life, was on every major national TV news show, such as ABC Good Morning America, wrote a book called The Last Lecture, which is probably one of the most seen YouTube videos where he gave a lecture to his students, The Last Lecture. And his final year was a kind of departure that can be reflected back onto the way we live, such as making choice, as you were just talking about. A phenomenon coming into play now is slow medicine, where people are saying, wait a minute, I'm not just going to embrace technological medicine because somebody says it might, big maybe, add another 6 months to my life. I may not choose to do that. I may want to live a more spiritual final months of my life. And I think if you back that into earlier years of aging, that has enormous implications for marketing and even the way we communicate marketing through advertising, because we start dealing with larger values of the meaning of life and the choices we have as we try to have a successful final part of our lives.
Yeah, absolutely. That's really interesting, and it's a great example. And you know, it brings to mind all of the news about Steve Jobs' death, and the tremendous circulation that his commencement address received. And what was he really telling people? He was saying, you know, don't lead someone else's life. Don't waste this opportunity by just conformity. And this is where, you know, we have to really look at ourselves in the mirror as marketers and say, are we in the business of trying to create conformity, or do we really think that it's possible to have a successful business and contribute at the level that we're describing? I believe that it is.
You know,
go ahead.
Oh, I didn't mean to cut you off, John. I was thinking that commencement address, if you take it apart and think of it in terms of marketing communications and messages that are on target for the zeitgeist of today, there's much fertile opportunity within that commencement address to talk about what's important and translate that into brand messages. That's just
absolutely. And it's not just, and let's face it, Apple is a technology company, but technology is not the answers to all of our problems. I mean, those of us who are parents of teenage children are so keenly aware that technology is also leveraging our pathologies, the worst characteristic of the culture. Technology and entertainment are distracting us from things that probably would help us to grow. So all of these so-called improvements are, you know, they're two-edged swords, and it's going to take some wisdom, I think, in the earlier years among educators and certainly among parents, to get people to see that, you know, they really do have a choice of where they spend, of where they direct attention. That may be the biggest idea of all, that we really can choose where we put our attention. And if we can choose how we define ourselves. And if we pay attention to things that distract or disintegrate, we're probably going to think of ourselves in that, you know, less significant manner that goes along with that. But if we think of ourselves, if we have an identity that really recognizes what now science is telling us, that we, whatever nature is or totality is, we're somehow an expression of it, and that what appears to be the separation really isn't that at all, that we really are connected with each other. And to make the point in the simplest terms, what happens to somebody far in a far away place really does affect us as well. So I think it's a fascinating challenge for business, how we're going to take advantage of not just the power of this technology, but the responsibility that we have as well. Because again, you know, going back to the earlier comment, businesses, global corporations, have probably become the preeminent social force.
That is truly a remarkable observation, and a fact, as I see it also. You have really taken on a way of thinking that is such a departure that what some people might expect of somebody that's worked in marketing their entire lives, and have been involved in embracing values that I think are reflecting a lot of things that you've said throughout this conversation, such as making good use of the gift of a longer life. What do you mean by that value? What does that say to you?
Well, first of all, let's just consider the fact that whether we live a long life or a short life, at some point or another, we become aware that this is going to end. And I guess it was a Samuel Johnson quote that, you know, if you're going to be hanged in a fortnight, it focuses the mind wonderfully. So, you know, again, whether we've got an extra 15 years or not, at least we have the opportunity now to think about things that are important, you know, to focus our mind wonderfully. And I think that, you know, that it is really a challenge to our culture. And I think one way of looking at it is, how do you describe the work that you, the generational work that you do? You said something that I really liked, the new generation or the regeneration.
Generation reinvention.
Generation reinvention. I love it.
Yeah, and that in a nutshell is to say that a generation, and our generation in particular, does not have to stop reinventing itself because it suddenly ages beyond a certain age. That one of the great opportunities and the great challenges for boomers and older generations is to reinvent this life stage so that we can all feel that we can take advantage of whatever gift of a longer life we might have to make a meaningful difference in the larger world. And that is part of, I think, our zeitgeist. I don't think it's just peculiar to my way of naming a show or a twist of words. I think it is actually the way it is. And the conversation that I have here every week with a parade of people like Ken Dykewald, David Wolfe, Mark Friedman, Dr. Bill Thomas, all of them are speaking to this conversation about how are we changing the world, and are we committed to do it so that we can fight the obstacles that are there? There is no question there are obstacles to changing the way the world thinks about anything, whether that's race relations or relations between the sexes or whatever. It takes work because people don't give up old stereotypes easily, and ageism is certainly one of the old stereotypes. But beyond this,
I really like that because it suggests that it is painful. Like birth is painful, and maybe what we need here is a second birth. And just like you know, we're born from our mother's womb the first time, now we need to be born out of our cultural womb. If there are aspects of the culture that we think are sick or are failing, and you know, if it's a foolish adherence to the status quo, or dethroning money as the only operational value, you know, we have to go through that painful process that you described to find those transcendent values. But as I say, it doesn't necessarily mean that we can't have a successful career at the same time. I think that there are more examples all the time of people, yourself included, who have found a way of making a very good living out of really attacking some of these questions and making a contribution to people understanding them.
Well, thank you very much for saying that, John. Are you optimistic, in a nutshell, that we're going to change aging and we're going to change the business world's relationship to aging in the ways that we idealistically envision?
Wow, that's a tough one. Yes, I am ultimately optimistic. in that I think, you know, if you look at nature, evolution is undeniable. It is just happening. Things are continuing to move all the time in new variety and new expression and growth. You also can't deny that there aren't some pretty ugly periods of dislocation along the way, which may even have some particular function in the growth and in the evolution. So, yes, I'm optimistic that that we will be able to see aging in a deeper and more beneficial and meaningful way, but it's certainly not going to be easy. And, you know, there's going to be a real, I think we're entering a period of tremendous stress and difficulty. And whether it's the economy or just the growth in the population and the available resources, we're in for some pain. But there's tremendous hope in some of the things that are being learned. You just can't you can't be exposed to what's being written and even what's winning Nobel Prizes in areas like physics that are reminding us that, what we think of as being temporal or as being separate isn't really that at all. And if we can start to incorporate this bigger identity of ourselves and the world that we live in into the way that we live and the choices that we make, and as I say, the places where we attract, where we put our own attention, I think amazing things are possible. And I see it in our business all the time. I was skeptical that you could take all of these separate companies and get people to work together and do the kind of things that we're doing right now, but yet it's happening. So there's great need. There's an endless adventure or odyssey that's evident in all of our experience. And I think that the trick is that we have to have an infinite context for every event and every situation.
I knew when we started this show we would not have enough time. I think I got to about half the questions that I had, but I want to thank you so much for joining the show, John. This has been a very enlightening and interesting conversation for me.
Well, me too. I really enjoyed it, Brent. I hope to see you soon, and thank you so much for the invitation.
I'm most pleased to have had you on the show, and I think the show has helped our listeners perhaps get a different perspective on the way that global marketing companies, particularly those under the WPP brand, are evolving to better address aging, branding, and consumerism. I believe that is the goal that these companies share. They want to be in touch with the heart of the way our society and our species is going and grapple with some of the larger problems of our time. And there's an organization that leads these in providing their marketing messages and strategies. And so I encourage you to go to WPP.com and check out what is going on. And then we've mentioned other companies within the family, such as Common Health. Check that out too. So I want to thank you, our listeners, for joining the show. As always, you can send direct messages to me on Twitter if you would like to communicate with me about this show, and that's at Boomer Marketing. So please tell your friends and colleagues and your clients about a worldwide boomer revolution, and we discuss it here weekly with some outstanding people like John Zweig, and we call it Generation Reinvention.
You've been listening to Generation Reinvention with your host, Brent Green. Visit Brent at his website at generationreinvention.com, and for archive shows, be sure to visit his show page here on the FMG Radio Network, where our motto is, have fun, make money.